Hey there, welcome to Board Game Hot Takes. My name's Tim.
And this is Chris.
This is Adam.
And today we're going to be talking about the game we just finished playing, Orléans. But before we do have some poll results to discuss. But before we do that, this week, the Board Game Geek Golden Geek nominations for Best Podcast were just announced. I have no idea if we won that because that's in the future for us, but it's in the present for you. Go to BoardGameGeek.com and check out the Golden Geek Awards. If we're one of the 10 podcasts that got nominated for Best Board Game Podcast, we would really appreciate it if you get out there and vote for us. The top three podcasts that get the most votes in this will get, obviously, first place and then some runner-up awards. So we'd love your vote, love to show up. Last year when we got nominated, it brought tons of new listeners. Lots of people checked us out for the first time. A runner-up spot would get us even more listeners. More people would get exposed to the show, learn about Board Game Hot Takes, and become a part of this great community. So please get out and vote for us. We would really appreciate it. All right, let's jump into our poll. This week, we're talking about the game Orléans, and our poll was about games based around French cities. A silly little poll here, the Battle of the Boards. So I said, which board game based on a city in France is your favorite? And the options I gave were Carcassonne, Orléans, or Paris. These are three well-known board games based on cities in France. And then also gave an other option. So 21% said Carcassonne, 50% said Orléans, 7% said Paris, and 21% said other. Now, I'm not going to ask you guys how you answered this because you just played Orléans for the first time tonight, or in Chris's case, the first time in a long time. So instead, I'm going to ask you, have you guys been to France? And if so, what's your favorite French city?
Tim, I have never been to France. I would love to go. I heard the south of France is beautiful. I'd love to go on the Mediterranean coast. But also up on the northwestern side, there's a patch that touches the ocean up there in a little surf town. I'd love to check out that part of France too. I don't know. There's so many board games about France with so many city names. I thought it was crazy and kind of comical. So I sort of suggested this post to you. I didn't know Paris actually had a board game, but it's Kiesling and Kramer, the famous duo, designed that one. Yeah. Yep. So I'd like to check that one out. But no, I've never been to France. I'd love to go. What about you, Tim? Have you ever been?
I've been to France. Yeah, once. It was actually my first international trip I ever took. I was 30 years old, way older than I should have been for my first international trip, especially to our European listeners who all you have to do is like drive an hour to get to another country. For us, it's a little bit further. Yeah, I went to Paris. My wife, I had just been dating her for about 6 months, and she recommended we take a trip together. Very awesome. I loved it. Paris was amazing. So it's my favorite French city that I visited because it's the only French city I visited. Yeah. What about you, Chris? Have you been to France?
I haven't. I've actually never been to continental Europe. I've only been to Ireland and to Iceland, both of which, of course, are islands. So I've never been to the continent. But I'd love to go to France. It looks like a wonderful place. I would probably not be so excited about Paris just because, to me, cities are kind of the same everywhere. I like going out into the countryside, and I want to go to one of those crazy little villages they have where you can like touch the buildings on either side of the street with a hand on each side, built into the hillsides with the little old historic buildings. That just sounds so charming to me. And I would love to go and drink some Alsatian Riesling.
Chris, Paris is not like any other city you've ever been in, I promise.
That's what they all say.
It doesn't even look like any other city you've been in. It's all old, well-planned buildings, these city blocks. It looks beautiful. It's awesome. You should check it out. Great museums, great monuments, great towers. It's a cool place. Great jazz too, by the way.
Just like every other city.
Anyway, so I'm not going to read a lot of comments from our listeners, but I will mention that it seems like most of our listeners have never been to France either, because I asked this poll and a lot of people recommended games that were not about cities in France. The first one we got in our Facebook group, I had to call out really quickly because it just made me laugh. The first one we got, David Rodriguez said, Praga Caput Regni. And I said, now you're just trolling. And he said, no, I really do love that game, but it's not set in France. Several people recommended Castles of Burgundy, which of course, Burgundy is not a city in France. It is a region of France, though. The one, though, that did come up several times that I hadn't thought about is Le Havre. Le Havre is a city. It's a port city in France. And that is supposed to be a great game. I'm excited to play it. In fact, a local friend and a listener of the show, I think Mel said she picked up a copy of this. And so I'm hoping to get this played with her soon. Le Havre, that is. But anyway, fun little question and interesting how many people were passionate about Orléans in this. So let's talk about how you guys feel about Orléans right after a description of the game.
In Orléans, 2 to 5 American players compete to see who can pronounce the name of this game with the least ridiculous French accent. Just kidding. What they're really doing is assembling the best team of farmers, merchants, monks, knights, and a variety of other very familiar characters to dominate the world of trade, science, and construction in medieval France, which I'm confident has never been done before. The action takes place over the course... That was a little sarcasm there in case you weren't reading it. The action will take place over the course of 18 rounds, each of which is further broken down into 7 distinct phases. This sounds like a lot, but in reality, most of what really matters in this game comes down to 2 things. Players drawing worker chips, which I'm saying with air quotes, from their personal bag and then assigning them to tasks, either on their player board or on a shared central board. Everything else will flow from the actions that the players take. And there are a lot of actions to choose from. Some are as simple as collecting another worker chip. Now, this is important for a couple of reasons. This game is a bag builder at heart, and the worker chips are what you're pulling from the bag. Also, the workers are all different. So, for example, a monk may be able to take an action that a knight can't, or a farmer can do things that a builder can't do. So having a bag full of the right workers is the key to success. The other actions are pretty diverse and range from spreading out your influence on a central map, building trading stations, collecting goods, and doing good deeds for points and other benefits. At the start of each round, players will reveal a new event tile that drives the action. This may include taking income, harvesting goods, paying taxes, and a variety of other actions that'll provide a benefit or a detriment to all the players. When the event tile deck runs out at the end of the game, players will tally their scores, and the player with the most points will be the winner. Orléans was designed by Rainer Stockhausen and is published by Capstone Games.
Thanks for that description, Chris. Now, this was my 35th game of Orléans, at least the ones that I've tracked, and there's probably quite a few more plays of it I've had other than that. So I've got a lot of experience with this one. Chris, I think this was your 3rd, if I remember right. I think you played this with me twice, about 5 years ago. And then Adam, this was your first play tonight. So we played on Tabletop Simulator, and we played with the Trade and Intrigue expansion. We played with a couple modules from it. We didn't play with everything in that expansion. I'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into the gameplay. But what do you guys think of the gameplay and mechanisms of Orléans?
Well, big picture wise, I thought it was incredibly fascinating, Tim. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on here. So it all spawns from this building of your bag and drawing out these little worker, these circles. You're drawing out circles that are different colors. And then you start with only, I think it's 4 circles. And then you're putting those out into the actions that you want to do. And you have to be able to completely fill in the action that you want to do with those colors of workers, the colors of circles, basically, to put it in abstract terms. So just that mechanism right there, I thought that was incredibly fascinating. I can't think of anything else that plays like that. It's not really worker placement. It's sort of like fractional action management, chip management. I don't know what you want to call it. It was really neat the way you're adding these colored circles into your bag, drawing them out, and from there, this explosion of actions and directions to go kind of happens. So this that mechanism right there is where I'll start.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of interesting decisions that come out of this, the way that your actions are chosen here, and it develops so uniquely over the course of this game, because you start the game with just 1 of 4 of the basic colors, and you can get more of those types of followers, but there's a couple other follower types that you can get over the course of the game as well. So I think there's a total of 7 different colors that you could get. And what this turns into is that you get these followers by taking actions on the board that are generally kind of building your engine. For example, you can go to the castle space and you pick up a knight follower, which is something you don't start with at the beginning of the game. And you need the knight follower to do certain other actions. But at the same time, it moves you up this little track. And the benefit that track gives you is that you then can draw more followers out of your bag in future rounds. You start at the beginning, you can only draw 4. The first time you take that castle action, you can then start to draw 5 the rest of the game, and it goes up from there. So sometimes you're going to be building your engine and you're like, okay, I want to keep doing that thing and making that part of my engine better. Except then you end up with this clutter of certain types of followers in your bag. And so that's a really fun choice that you have to play around. So sometimes you're pulling followers out of your bag and you're like, oh, I got all these followers. Oh, except they're all red ones now. But my favorite part of the game comes from this action called the Town Hall. So the way the Town Hall works is that this is the way you can kind of scrap your workers. You can get rid of some of those workers you don't want, and you can get benefits for it. So what happens is you can put up to 2 of your followers on this Town Hall action, and then they go over to this good deeds board that is a whole bunch of benefits you can get. And each of the benefits only takes certain colors of workers there. And once a worker is placed there, it's gone out of your bag and it blocks that spot for the rest of the game. So a couple fun things happen there. One is that there's just a variety of benefits you can get. So sometimes you're like, I just need two coins. So you can just scrap one worker, get the two coins you need for whatever reason. But also once you fill up a section, once there's like three or four followers in a section, then there's an extra benefit. So there's a little bit of a tension about the race. Do I want to place a follower there and set somebody else up to place two followers there next turn? So all that stuff is super fun. What makes this good is this is one of the modules of the Trade and Intrigue expansion that we played with. Because the base game has this whole mechanism, but that board, that good deeds board that you're sending workers to is much less interesting. I don't remember what all the benefits are, but mostly I think you just get a couple of coins when you send a worker out to one of those spaces, and then a follower when you fill up a section. So less interesting. This one is a whole variety of different benefits you could get. I really like that. And that for me always creates some of the most interesting tension. The biggest reason to watch what the other players are doing and what followers they've got and what spaces are left on that board. So I always have a really fun time with that. You guys picked it up quickly. We filled up that whole board tonight. I play a lot of the time with people who just don't get the benefit of they're like, I don't want to give up a follower, you know, especially on a first play. They're like, I don't want to lose my followers. I'm not going to send people there, but it can be such a huge advantage. Aside from just slimming out your bag and kind of keeping a smaller selection so that you're more likely to be drawing a good variety of workers.
Yeah, that race is huge. And I mean, by the end of this, I was trying to get rid of workers out of my bag, trying to get rid of these chips, and I couldn't do it anymore because you guys had taken up all the good spots. And there was actually one round right toward the very end where there was like exactly one big spot left that was going to let you do something really good. And it all came down to who was the first player. And it turned out that round, Tim was the first player. So he ended up getting that spot. That was super intense. And at first, it didn't feel like it was going to be. Because really, at the beginning of the game, you've only got those four workers. And you're trying to draw out as many as you can. And you really don't have any. And so you're quickly trying to build up this bag. But then as soon as you get that bag built up, now you're starting to whittle it down again. And I think that's one of the things that was fun about this, because in a way, this felt to me like deck building, which is one of my favorite types of games. And I love scrapping more than I love anything when it comes to deck building. And in this one, the mechanism of the good deeds board was like scrapping with benefits, which you don't always get with deck building. A lot of times you're just scrapping for the sake of scrapping. I loved that. I thought that was a lot of fun. But I actually want to come back really quickly to a point that Adam made. Like, what is this game? Because it's not exactly worker placement. I mean, you're placing these guys, these workers, so that you can take actions, but you're not blocking anybody else out and you're not competing for spaces. So you're not, other than maybe on the good deeds board. It's not exactly worker placement. And then I thought, well, maybe it's more like just using resources. You're putting the resources out there. Your workers are resources that are going to get you this action or that action. But that's not really right either, because at the end of the round, you get all of your workers back. So it's not exactly like just using resources either. So, I mean, what do you call this? Is there a category for this, or is it just...
It's still more worker placement than Star Wars Rebellion is.
Yeah, I can't concur. I cannot concur. A couple things you said, Tim. I think that town hall action, the good deeds board, that was definitely my favorite part of the game. Going over there, a couple moments of the game, you have that one spot with this expansion where you can throw one of your workery, chippy guys up there just to get rid of it, and you can draw one right out of your bag, and you could throw it right back up there if you wanted to. You get to keep kind of going unless you get one of your starter chips. Then you can't throw that one away. So that one has to be retained on your board or in your drawn circle spot. So I had that moment where I drew a guy. It wasn't quite what I wanted, but I was able to put that somewhere else. And that next draw was exactly the piece I needed. And it got me to the final spot on that place. So I got to get my little bonus from that thing and the action I wanted to do. So some neat moments come from that good deeds board. And then Chris said it too, the first player was a big deal. I like how first player has to set their board before the second player in turn order has to set their board. So you can kind of look and you say, oh, well, shoot, Tim's going to take that action first. So he can take this action before I can get to it. But in this case, and this happened in the game, I'm going to have to threaten this action anyway to make sure Tim does that action, even though I might not be able to get to it if Tim does take it. So there's this little cat and mouse going on with the way that you're going to adjust what actions you're going to take during the course of the round, if that makes any sense. So that aspect of the game was cool. Chris, you mentioned scrapping with benefits. Everybody loves scrap with benefits. And then you also mentioned that all chips go back in the bag every round. I thought that was a unique element of this game too. So unlike deck building, where you know you've seen your crappy cards this hand, so your next hand, you know, is going to be all the good cards that you spend all this money on and stuff. You don't know what chips are going to come out every time. It could be your starter workers every time, unless you could put some of your chips out in spots that were kind of worthless and leave them out there on the board, which is a neat little nuance of this game. I'm going to put these starting workers out here in the university spot that's been gone since six rounds ago. So the way you're kind of managing your chip was different and unique. And I really enjoyed that aspect of the game as well.
Yeah. And going back to what Adam said about the first player having to lock in their chips. But the thing is like the whole planning phase where everyone's putting their chips on their board is simultaneous up until the moment that the first player says, okay, I'm done. Then the other players can choose to adjust in response. Yep. But generally, I mean, it's only a few turns where you're not already expecting what the first player might do to get in your way. And so you don't often have to make that change, which means that the planning phase, which is the longest piece of the game, happens simultaneous. And it feels like it goes pretty quick. About the time you're done wrapping up where you're going to put your workers, everybody else is. You're not waiting a long time here. That turns into the actions phase, though, where you start going around and taking the actions. And that also goes really snappy. So this is played over 18 rounds. It feels like this game could go on forever. And I think Chris would say it probably felt like it did go on forever tonight, just because how much he was yawning by the time we got done at the end of the game. I think when everybody knows the game, rounds go quick, turns go quick. You never feel like there's much downtime. It's just constant move, move, move. There's also, like Chris said, like seven phases in the game, but most of them are move the first player token, give a coin to the person who's furthest up this one track, etc. That all said, my favorite part of this game, aside from that good deeds board, is just the general engine building that happens here. And it's so clever because when you take an action that gives you one of those new followers, you're always getting some bump up. I mentioned the knights already, but there are these ones that will give you these buildings, which are like these extra tiles you put next to your board, and they might be new worker placement spaces. They might be, you know, to some ongoing benefit, some end game scoring benefit. There's this other one that lets you put these little technology tiles on your board. So you get one of these woodsman workers, which are these brown workers, and then you put a technology tile on a space on your board to cover up one of the spaces of followers to go in. So it makes your actions cheaper. So there's just constant engine building in this game. It's like everything you do is going to make the future game a little bit more efficient or a little bit more interesting. And I think that's really cool. And it's neat because there is this great arc to the game where the first turn of the game, everyone's going to take one action. That's all you can take. And you got to choose which of those actions you're going to take, which of those parts of your engine you're going to build first. And the first few rounds, all you're doing is building your engine. But then you start to transfer over to this map board where people are moving around and putting guild trading houses or whatever, these little buildings out on the board. And that's kind of what the end game turns into. Then it's this competition, this race. Okay, I got to get moving. I got to get building these guild houses so they turn into points. So it's a really cool arc from turning that engine building into point generation, but in an interesting way that the point generation turns into this cool competition where you're really doing something that seems fun.
Yeah, I want to go back to the time aspect of this for a minute, because I think that was something that really kind of stuck out to me. The initial rounds go so fast. I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that we were proceeding through the first half dozen rounds or so at about, you know, I don't know, 2 to 3 minutes for a round, because there wasn't that much you could do and you weren't thinking maybe as strategically yet and didn't have the right pieces on the board to be able to take a lot of actions. And then it started to slow down quite a bit. I'm not sure if that would change a lot depending on your experience with the game, because I felt like we were moving pretty quickly. I think we got it pretty quickly and we jumped right in. I mean, we jumped in at our starting time today and we went just about 3 hours, which felt fairly long. Like I sort of felt like there was an arc to it where at the beginning we were flying. And then by the middle of the game, it hit a sweet spot and every turn was incredibly rewarding, because I was able to do all kinds of cool things. And then by the last few rounds, I was starting to, you know, kind of drum my fingers and say, all right, I wish these rounds were going a little bit faster than they were. So I don't want to make too much of that because it didn't bother me that much. And maybe that would go a little quicker at a lower player count, or if we, you know, we're playing, this is my third game, I guess. So my fifth or sixth or seventh game, but I'd be curious to see how that goes on subsequent plays.
The good news is I can answer this for you, Chris, because I played it 35 to 40 times. And I can tell you that this is not usually a 3-hour game, even though there is a lot of rounds in it. It is usually three players, okay, 2 hours or less, hour and a half to 2 hours. So still not a short game,
okay,
but it's not a 3-hour game. And I can guarantee you this because I play it with my wife and I play it with our friend Jen a lot, and neither of them would ever sit through a 3-hour game.
Okay.
So I guarantee you we're done within 2 hours. Other than this, they wouldn't keep asking for this game.
That's good to hear.
I think Chris is right, though. There is, at the beginning of the game, there's not much to do, but in the middle of the game, you have a full bag of circles, and then you're going to be able to draw 6, 7, 8 more workers out. And you're going to have workers that are left over from previous rounds, maybe one or two workers here. So you're going to be able to do, instead of 2 or 3 actions per round, maybe you're up to 4 or 5 actions per round. So there is going to be that middle section of the game where there's going to be more actions taken per person. So I could see where it did kind of draw out. I felt that, Chris. And I can see that happen in future games. But if Tim says it's going to get shorter, not too long, I got to go with what Tim's saying.
And I believe him.
In all fairness, this was the first time in a long time that I've played with Chris at the game. So maybe it's the players playing.
I don't know.
Let's see where this is going. One thing we haven't talked about yet was the big old map. There's a big old boring brown map over there, which gets the job done. It's not overly complicated and overly involved, which I thought was nice. One of the actions you can do is set sail, or you can drive a wagon, and you just move your little character that's on the map one space over, and you can pick up a little good along the way. And then you could put a little guild house or trading station, whatever you want to call them. I think it's a guild house action that lets you put in a trading station on the map, is the correct vernacular. I thought that was quick and simple and not overly complicated and a nice little interaction element. What do you guys think of the map?
Again, I think it's always fun because it's one more place where, for a euro, there is a lot of interaction in this game. That, you know, we talked about the good deeds board. The map is the other place, and it can depend game to game, but because there's all these goods that are randomly placed around the map, so that, and some of them are worth more value, like straight up, like some of the goods on the map are worth 5 points, some of them are worth 1 point, and there's some in between. So of course you want to get to the silk, that 5 point tokens. So people are generally going to be motivated to kind of move to the richer areas of the map, which is, you know, always creates this tension where if I get there and I put a trading house down, or guild house trade, I don't know, the trading house, what's good, trading station. If I put a trading station down, you can't put one there anymore. And then all of a sudden you got to redirect, you got to go a different direction, or try to take two actions and get ahead of me so that you can place one there next. So fun interaction on the board. You know, deck builders do this, right? They turn from where you're engine building into point getting. I don't usually like the point getting, but in this case, the point getting is at least fun. You're still taking those interesting decisions to first take a move action, and then you get that good out of it, and then you get to place the trading station. So I will never get that right. So I think at least for just end game point getting, and something you can kind of do throughout the game in small doses, I think it's interesting. I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I agree. I also like the map. I don't think it added anything particularly unique, but I think it added something very useful. You needed some way, like you said, Tim, to convert those actions into points. This is a nice way to do that. It also gave a little bit of a diversion from thinking about those little things that are happening on your player board. Basically, you just had to have something in this game that was a diversion from placing these little chips down on your player board. And this did it, I thought, perfectly fine. I thought that was a really enjoyable, not too complicated way of implementing that. In fact, that's my overall observation of this game. Nothing was too complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some interesting decisions to be made all the time, but nothing was too complicated. It was an incredibly easy game to learn and to get into pretty quickly.
I think the biggest complication in the game, and Tim mentioned it a couple of times, were all these building tiles and the different things that they could do. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest complication. So, oh shoot, there's like, I don't know how many of each level 1 and level 2, 20 or 20 to 30 of each of those. So you're able to get one of those and you're like, what do I want to do now? And I'm going to look through these 20 tiles and flip around. And that's kind of guide my strategy the rest of the game. There was some that reward set collection. So maybe that's going to guide how you move around the map or collect these goods. You have to think about that for a little bit. Am I going to be able to do this or do that? Does this make sense? So While none of those individually were complicated, the decision of which one to pick was a chore.
Yeah, and probably one of the things that slowed the game down. And so, those buildings are probably one of my favorite parts about the game and one of my least favorite parts about the game. And the reason it's one of my favorite parts is that it lets everyone kind of build a unique engine, take unique actions, give people different directions once you've built them. The problem is the way that it was implemented in this game. The way that it's implemented is that when you can take a building, you can pick one from the 40 tiles that are available. You've got a huge stack there. You have to make a choice. Now, I've taught this game to new players sitting at a table without tool tips. It's just iconography on these things. How does a new player make a decision on that? And if they're going to look through the appendix and read what all those things do, how long do you think that's going to take? So teaching a new player this game with the rule, the way that it's written in the rule book like that, is not, it's not a good experience. I just found it to be a miserable experience the couple times I played like that. I immediately, now this is sacrilege, I don't do this often, but I almost immediately implemented a house rule. This is something that I was thinking
about.
What
did you say, Tim?
I know.
Are you what?
It's something that I did find a Board Game Geek post at the time, and I was like, this is exactly what this game needed, and I've played it this way ever since. So this is how I play the game, and I would recommend it. I really would. Instead of having these two stacks of level one and level two buildings that you can choose from, you have the two stacks, and then you only put a market of three of each tile up. So that when somebody is going to build a level one tile, they have three choices to make. It does two things. One, it makes the decision space a lot smaller and quicker and easier to teach people. When those three tiles are up, you just tell them what they do at the beginning of the game. When one gets replaced, you just explain what the new tile does. Super easy to do that. The other reason why this is great, though, is because there is stronger buildings in those stacks. There are better buildings. I played this with some experienced players once. And there was no doubt. The first person takes their first turn, they go and they grab one specific building, and the other players at the table are like, dang it, of course, first player got that building. Well, that's no fun. Then it means that everybody's first turn is scripted. Everybody knows what the right first action to do is. In this way, there's a level of variance, which I really like, even in Euro games, to where your game is going to play out different every game. There's going to be a variety of what's going to come up. You might be building towards a strategy and not see that one building, but that's okay. Maybe it does come up, though. Maybe a strategy you've been working towards, all of a sudden a building comes up that works with it. That's exciting. So for me, I would highly recommend playing it this way. I think you guys would have enjoyed it and found that it went quicker if we'd played that way. But I did want you guys to play with the original rule just so you could kind of see how it's written. What do you think? Do you think that would have been preferable to you, or do you think you would have felt like it was too luck driven, or how would you play it if you had a choice?
I would play it using your house rule. I think that's the way to go. There were too many tiles. I mean, there was a lot of tiles out there, and I didn't even bother looking through all of them. I just didn't have the patience to too much iconography, even with the tool tips. And they're important. I mean, I had a tile that I ended up getting that let me jump to the various stages along the development track, which, I mean, I still lost handily, but I mean, it put me in striking range of you guys. You know, it kept me competitive in the game. And so having to parse through all that and try to figure it out without really knowing it well, I think would be very frustrating. And that, you know, actually what it reminds me of is Barrage, where you have those tiles that come out, I forget what they're called, patent tiles, I think. There's the wrench tile, the one that everybody goes for. It sounds like the tile you were describing there. But, you know, maybe you see it, maybe you don't see it. But not having all of that laid out in front of you, I think, would add some nice variability and take away some unnecessary complexity.
In your games, Tim, do you take that tile out or you leave it in there? What is that tile that's very strong?
Well, frankly, I don't even remember what it was. Again, I wasn't the experienced player at the table.
Is that why you beat us by 40, 50 points?
Well, I didn't use that tile, I can tell you that. I think it was the one that I showed you guys, the bathhouse one, where you get an extra pole at the beginning. There's another one that I think it's called the guard tower or something, where you can place workers on this board, so you could basically end up sending up to four workers up to the good deeds board every round, so it makes it easier to race it. Cool. But anyway, there's a couple out there that are just really strong. But I'll give you another example. Like, there's these five tiles in the board in the game that let you place one or two workers on them and you get a good. And of course, the goods have different value, right? So one of the tiles, you place two workers, you get a silk worth 5 points. Another one, you place two workers, you get a wine, which is worth 3 points. Why would you choose one over the other on that one? I mean, the types of workers you have to use may be a little bit more difficult to get, but I can tell you that I would never choose the one that gives me the cheese when I could get the one that gives me the silk, because it's just a clear, straightforward, better tile. Anyway, again, that's how I prefer to play this game, and I'm not a big fan of house rules. I'm opposed to it, but honestly, I think if I had not used this house rule, I wouldn't still be playing this game. I just think it's not a good game to introduce people to in that way, and it just slows everything down. So anyway, that's my little tip here. Now, we did play again with the Trade and Intrigue expansion, which added some additional tiles there, which is good because it adds variety, but bad because it adds more choices. And then there was also some promo tiles in here. So we had quite a few. But anyway, I think it's really fun when you've got that mix. Let's jump into the theme and production of Orléans.
Here is what kept me away from the game for so long. A big part of what kept me away from the game for so long. I don't care about trading in France in brown colors and Clemens Franz artwork is just a huge turnoff for me in general. Having said that, I found it slightly charming in an old-timey, board gamey kind of a way. The player boards were nice and useful. The map was clean and easy to use, and the little tracks were just fine. But again, nothing like stood out and was, you know, extraordinarily exciting. It's a very resource tradey, kind of dull but functional game for me.
Yeah, pretty much agreed. This is probably my favorite Clemens Franz production as far as artwork, just the board layout, the, you know, all the stuff that's on the board. The little follower tiles are colorful and easy to distinguish for the most part. I like the presentation here. I can't wait to hear what Chris has to say because he's got a huge smirk on his face right now. So I do have one ping on the production here, and that is primarily that there's a lot of cardboard chits in this, and the setup is huge because of it. Like that whole, all the goods tiles are these white square tiles with a good printed on them. So kind of ugly, not very, you know, interesting to look at. But you have, I don't know, somewhere around 110 of these in this bag. And at the start of the game, you got to pull out a certain amount based on player count. And then you have to randomly seed that board based on the number of players. And then you have to stack up all the remaining ones in their five types and put them on a spot on the board because it's a limited supply. So you got to be able, people have to be able to see how many are left so that if they're going for like trying to get a lot of cheese or something, they know that it could run out. So it's a ton of setup. And then with all the followers, that's different per player count. So at the beginning of the game, you got to pull out a certain number of them and then stack all the remaining chits on the board. So it's a lot of cardboard. It's a lot of setup. I think it's worth it, but it's like a good 15 to 20 minutes every time I want to get this game set up, and one of the longer ones of games that I play regularly.
Oh boy. All right. Where to begin? Well, first of all, it's like they had a contest to see who could come up with the least possible engaging theme you could put on a board game. And Reiner Stockhausen said, "Hold my beer." And then, you know, add to that this really weird cartoony art that's on this thing. I mean, I'm looking at the box cover right now, and I don't know what this is or what it means, but there's like these people all waving and pointing at each other, and there's like this odd looking knight that's got a face come out of the side of his head instead of, well, it's not even a face, it's like a little slit on his helmet to look out of, but it's coming out of the side of his head instead of the front of it. And then there's like a weird bow-legged lady with a cane. And I don't know what's going on there. I don't get the artistic choice in this. Maybe that's supposed to be reminiscent of some kind of medieval art. But honestly, I found myself half of the game looking at the box cover going, my God, what is happening here? Instead of actually looking at the game. So now, lest you think that is the sum total of my opinion of the game, stick around for the end result of all this, the do we want to play it again? But my goodness, the production on this game, I was driven to distraction by how frustrating I found the production and the theme to be.
Well, that strange-looking knight helmet on the front cover notwithstanding, like I said, I actually don't mind the artwork in production. I do think it has an intentional look to feel like a medieval type of art style with a comical overlay to it, and it doesn't bother me at all. So, but I get it. That knight helmet, I don't know if that was a choice or an accident, but neither makes sense in all fairness. Otherwise, it's fine. And yeah, the medieval farming thing, boring, boring, boring. It seems like the world's getting away from that these days, and I'm glad about that. It seems like we're moving into more thematic, more interesting themes, and more interesting productions overall. So let's move into our final thoughts, and that is, would you request to play Orléans again?
I would request to play this one again. I had a great time playing it, as long as I don't have to set it up, but the mechanics were all here, the interaction was here, I had so much fun managing my little circles coming out of this bag. And how am I going to use these? What actions am I going to do? Where am I going to go around on this map? What do all these different buildings do? I have no clue. Maybe I'll learn two or three at a time per session. But a lot of fun choices going on in this game. I would absolutely request to play Orléans again.
Nice. I've played this game, like I said, 35 sometimes. I think it's really fun. I personally don't request it very often because it's a decent amount of setup, and I think there are just other games that I have a little bit more fun with. But because I have some friends that love it, I'm excited when they ask for it. I love playing meaty Euros, and this qualifies, and so it's great when friends are looking to play it. So fun game that I would say I'm, you know, a moderate fan of. If my wife and our close friend did not really enjoy this game, I probably wouldn't keep it in my collection, but I'd always be happy to play it.
Well, so here's where it gets a little bit weird for me, because I mean, I don't think I had anything nice to say about the production. I didn't have much nice to say about the theme of this game. And I definitely feel like there was a point maybe where it outlived its welcome just a little bit. But holy cow, I had such a good time playing this game tonight. It's like Pumbaa said about the slugs in The Lion King. There's something oddly satisfying about this. Like putting out those chips and getting those actions, especially as you're building up your turns and building up your actions and your ability to do more things on a turn. That felt so good. So I actually had a terrific time playing this game tonight, and I absolutely would ask to play this one again.
Awesome. The one thing I wanted to mention, so we played with the Trade and Intrigue expansion. So really quickly, we talked about the extra good deeds board, which is awesome. We didn't talk about the events in the game, which I think is a really fun part of the game. Basically, the beginning of each round, you turn over a tile. There's, of course, 18 of them because it's 18 rounds. You turn over a tile, and it tells you what event is going to happen at the end of the round, or in some cases, it's an event that changes the game during the course of that round. And in the base game, I think there's only four or maybe five types of events. They're randomly shuffled in there, but they're all going to show up several times. And it got old really quickly. You could clearly plan for the couple things you needed to do. The Trade and Intrigue expansion gives you a huge variety. It's something like 32 different event tiles, and only 16 of them are going to come out. So it adds a huge amount of variety. For me, it's fun because they show up at the beginning of the round. You can plan for it, so it's never too punishing or anything like that, but it gives you some little challenges to work around every round. The last thing that comes in the Trade and Intrigue expansion, which we didn't play with, is this trade module where you're literally given orders where you can move around the map, get to certain locations, and then trade in goods. We didn't play with that tonight. It's pretty fun, though. Bottom line, I just wanted to say, if you buy this game, buy the Trade and Intrigue expansion. It is a lesser game without it. It never would have gotten as many plays as it did if I didn't have it.
Tim, what are your thoughts on ideal player count for this game?
Three.
Okay.
Always three.
All right.
And I'll second that comment Tim just made about the expansion, because even though, I mean, I guess I did technically play it without the expansion maybe one time, but it was so long ago, I don't remember. But I can clearly see if we kept seeing the same events over and over again tonight, it wouldn't have been half the game that it was.
Yeah. Well, that'll wrap up our conversation on Orléans. Oh, and by the way, this game was picked by our Patreon supporters. So if you didn't enjoy this conversation, get out there, be a part of it. Join us on patreon.com/boardgamehottakes, and you can vote on future content that we make. Let's jump into some games that have been on our table right after this. Welcome back. What have you guys been playing this week?
Galactic Renaissance, the Kickstarter published by Matigo Games, and the designer is Christian Martinez. It's the same duo that did Inish. So there's some pedigree there. The art here, I'll mention it, Tano Bonfanti. Let me just say the art is fantastic and beautiful, and that comes in the form mostly of art on the cards, which is a big part of this game. So everybody has a similar starting deck. I think there's seven cards that all do various actions. You're going to add in one kind of special card, one unique card. So there's a little bit of asymmetry as you're going, in addition to the planet that everybody starts with. You have a hand of cards, you're going to do some hand management, and you're going to do some people management. So this is kind of a strange area control game. I'm going to bring this one up to the mountains with us. I'm going to teach this game to you guys. So we're going to try it out up there. I'm going to get your thoughts. But briefly, in general, You're going to have this world that develops. These planets are going to pop out, and you're going to be able to porthole. You're going to be a porthole. You're going to be able to portal to these different planets through these little gates. So you have access to some planets, or maybe some planets are only sort of connected to other planets. So unlike a physical game board, you just have these different planets that are connected through these imaginary paths. There's no canals and there's no train tracks. There's nothing physical like that. And they just go through these different things. So that's how these planets are connected, which I think that's kind of a neat mechanism. Every little planet does something kind of different. There's a little card that comes out with them. And it's not strict area control. It's more sort of diplomatic is a big selling point of the game. So you have all these ambassadors that you're going to put out on these planets, and there's different criteria for them. So maybe you want to have the majority, straight up majority on one planet, and that'll give you some points. Maybe you just want to have two of your ambassadors there, and for some reason, that's worth some points. Maybe you want to have the fewest ambassadors there, and that'll give you some points. So there's just different scoring criteria that are going to get you different points throughout the course of the game. So that's kind of neat. The scoring criteria evolves as you go on. So say if somebody gets 8, 9, 10 points, I forget what it is, but then there's a threshold that they cross and a new scoring card turns up. So now you're going to have more ways to score as the game goes. How do you even score in the first place? Well, it's one of your cards. You take one of your cards, you send one of your ambassadors, or you pull one of your ambassadors back from the hub planet, the home planet that everybody kind of meets at, and that activates your scoring. It's unique. So you guys will have a chance to see that. And again, as the game progresses, these scoring cards change. There's kind of three up at the top, three slots. You start with only two, cross a threshold. A third one pops up, cross the next threshold. That first one flips over and there's a different scoring card on the top. So now one of your scoring criteria is gone and replaced with this new scoring criteria. And then that happens one more time. So you end up with three different scoring criteria than you began the game with. So that's kind of neat. Also, it's a card play game. You're going to play a card and do what it says, move your guys around, bring some guys back, draw a new card or purchase a card from here or make a new planet. A lot like the actions in Innis, if you remember. So there's like a explore a new planet that pops out a new planet, maybe put some guys on there. You get to select a little portal that's going to be connected to your other planets. And then you move the cosmic rabbit to the next one. Of course, there's a cosmic rabbit. Why not? The trick is once you play a card, you might be able to play another card and another card. So some cards are play it and then stop. Some cards are play it and you get to keep going. The order that you play these cards kind of matters too, because you don't reshuffle your deck. You just scoop those up and put them right underneath your deck. So you're kind of managing the order that these cards come out in addition to how many other cards are coming into your deck. So there's a little bit of interplay there. So some neat stuff going on here. I played this one at two, just one time with my dad. The scoring criteria got to this a little bit of a stalematey situation at the end of the game, which might have been a function of the two players. So that was a little odd, we'll say. So I'm interested to bring this one to you guys and see what you think. I'm a little hesitant on gameplay at this point. Overall, it seems good. That stalematey scoring conditions was a little funky for me, so that left a sour taste. I'm excited to try this one at three players. I just said a lot of words. What do you guys think about Galactic Renaissance?
Well, I'm looking at pictures on this, and I remember you talking about this either when you first backed it or maybe at one of our Kickstarter episodes, but this is some of the coolest artwork. This kind of sci-fi artwork. I love it. I can't wait to look at these cards up close. Now, when you look at the components, it looks like a few, you know, kind of like discs around the kind of in the player area. There's not a big map or anything. And then a bunch of little tokens and components around it, which to me, this looked like it was going to be a lighter game. I'm thinking this is going to be like a Capital Lux 2 level weight, but it's actually rated a 3. And after you just explained all that stuff, I can see why it's probably got a little bit more weight than it appears based on the components. Very interested in trying it. I don't know if it's going to be for me, you know, because like it depends. Some area control games can be when you're talking about things where you mentioned diplomacy. Does that mean that we're actually like having conversations, or is that just a kind of a theme of the game is diplomacy?
No. So there's no like, give me this and I'll give you that. Okay. And we got to try this and try that.
That's afraid.
No, so Chris is a big sigh of relief over there too. You don't necessarily need area majority, and it's not like fight, fight, fight. And I kill all your guys. There's a little bit of that, but it's more like, I'm going to gently ask you to go back to your home planet for a little while. And we're going to build a little structure here. So I'm going to ask you to move off your space. Oh, now you want to come and add some more players here. Well, all right, I guess I'll move off to this planet and I'll try something else. So it's more a way of manipulating your figures, your characters and stuff around the galaxy to set yourself up for a good position to score a lot of points when you cross those thresholds.
It does sound fascinating, the idea of diplomacy as the area of majority control, whatever you want to call it, as opposed to combat. But I'll reserve judgment until we get a chance to play it, since that's coming up very soon. But my question is, were you serious about the Cosmic Rabbit?
So I don't know why it's called the Cosmic Rabbit. There's actually a card that you get to do something special with this Cosmic. The Cosmic Rabbit is just a little character. There's three different portals. I don't know why I'm in trouble saying that word. There's a red, a circle and a triangle and a square. And the rabbit's just a tracker for the next portal that's going to pop out. So when you build a new planet, whatever the Cosmic Rabbit's on, maybe he's on the circles, you grab that. And that's how that planet's going to be connected to the rest of the universe. And then the rabbit moves on to the next shape. So there's only three shapes. He goes around, around, and around. And he just hands out the portal. So he's somehow connects the worlds via these portals. And his card, when that pops up, it's pretty powerful. It gives you a great action. And then that gets shuffled back in to the available cards.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
Not to be confused with the Cosmic Frog.
Totally different.
If he shows up, he eats your planet.
That's right.
Or part of a planet, as I've heard.
Part of a planet.
All right. Well, speaking of beautiful artwork, I got a chance to play The Veil of Eternity this week. And I wanted to talk about this because this was one of the options on our poll for which game we played tonight. And this got second choice. So to those of you that voted for Veil of Eternity on our Patreon poll, you get to hear a little bit about it. This game is absolutely beautiful. It has some of the coolest fantasy artwork. It's a card-driven game, and all of the cards represent different mythical creatures, and it's a huge variety. Mythical creatures you know from Greek mythology, for example. Cerebrus is in here. But then there's also mythical creatures from Eastern civilization. There's what looks like just fantasy creatures, but they're all put in this really kind of more fantasy, almost Pokemon style artwork, but really nice, like where Pokemon is more cartoony. These have beautiful backgrounds, beautiful painted illustrations throughout them. Let's move on past the production for a second. This game is a blast. Okay, so this is a little card-driven tableau engine builder. Think along the lines of, if you ever played Seasons or Res Arcana, those are some good comparisons. The way it works is you've got this, what is essentially a pentagon in the middle of the table. It's shaped a little different, but it's got five sides to it. And so at the start of each round, you're going to deal twice the number of cards as there are players. So in our game, we played with three players, so six cards were dealt out. Now, each of the sides of this pentagon represent one of the elements. It's your typical fire, wind, air, and earth. And then there's a dragon element. So those are your five elements. But basically, whatever cards come up, you put them on the side of the pentagon, and this is like a little marketplace. And every player is going to have these two bidding pawns. And these are nice, big, wooden, chunky tokens. You're going to do a snake draft. So you got these six cards out. Each player is going to end up getting two cards. So first person is going to reserve their first one, then second person, then third person. And then the third person gets to reserve the next one, and it comes back down. So everyone will have reserved two. And then in player order, you basically do something with those two cards that you reserved. You either can take the card into your hand so that it's available for you to play, or you can basically sell the card, the monster that you just reserved. This is one of the really neat things about it. The way the economy works is that you can never have more than, I think it's four element stones. The element stones are the type of currency, but they're different denominations. There's a one, a three, and a six. So if you take, for example, the fire element, it just gives you three ones. If you take the earth element, I think it gives you four ones. But if you take the water element, it's going to give you a three token. So you would think, okay, well, the four ones is better than the three, except if you get the four ones, you've just used up all the space for currency. You can't pick up any more tokens in your hand. So that's a really interesting choice. Not only are you deciding whether you want to bid on one, but you might bid on the dragon, one of the dragon cards, because you can just get a six if you just sell it instead of actually getting the card for it. So it's a really cool decision. The reason you're getting these dragons or these element stones is because you're actually going to spend them to play the cards that are in your hand. Now, this game is played either to 10 rounds or it's played to 40 points. But the way all these cards work is, let's say you had a card in your hand in the first round, you can only have a maximum of one card in your tableau. So you couldn't actually play two in the first round, but you could play one card. Each of the cards either does something when you play it, it does something at the end of the round, or it does something like there's an ongoing effect on some of them. So you're trying to build up this tableau where these cards combo together. So you might have a card that says gain two coins for each grass element you have in your tableau. And so then you're trying to collect other grass elements to go with it. But there's lots of interactions that are more interesting than that. Lots of cards that let you return other cards to your hand to get a benefit, to get coins. Cards that let you mess with other people's tableaus. This feels like a really light version of like a Magic the Gathering, a card-driven fantasy-based game. I mentioned Seasons. That's a great example where you're kind of using a different type of purchase mechanism to buy this tableau of cards and build up a tableau of cards that turns into a little engine that gets going and escalating over the course of the game. Really fun, beautiful artwork. I had a blast with this. I want to play it again. I only played it one time. I thought it was awesome. I thought for what is a little tiny box, it was an amazing production and a really wonderful engine builder. I think, you know, just the variety in cards, the variety of different combinations you can get, just this is going to bring it back to the table so many times. And I think you could have a blast with it.
Tim, I think the art looks charming here. How many players did you play this one at?
Oh, I played three. It's got to play up to four. It definitely plays up to four, at least. I'm checking the player count right here now. It goes up to four players. Yeah. So we played it at three and it was awesome. I think it would be pretty fun at two even. More fun at three because there is some interaction and racing. But I think even at two, one of the guys I played with said they did like it even more at four, though, because it's just more cards out there in the market every round. So okay. You just have more choices to auction from.
It was pretty brisk. Like how long did it take to play the game?
Yeah, we played a three-player game with the teach was probably 45 minutes. So probably 30-35 minutes after everybody knows it.
Did you run it back a couple times? Did you just play it the one time? Or is this one you would see yourself?
We started at like 11:30 at night. So just played it one time this time. But I wanted to. Like I would have been happy to jump back into it and play again. Now, the one thing I'll say, I think this is ripe for expansions. And I'm guessing there will be if it sells well. Because even in the three-player game, we made it almost all the way through the whole deck of cards. And so even though there's a variety and whose tableau they come up in is going to be a little bit different, I didn't like that you're going to see almost every card in the first game. One of the things I like about games like this is where there's exploration, where every once in a while you're like, oh, I haven't seen that card in a while. That's cool. And it goes really well with this thing that I've never seen it go with before. So, I mean, again, I think it's a great value for this little box, how much is in there. And I think it's going to be a ton of gameplay, but I think add one expansion that adds another 50% cards in there. And then all of a sudden it's like, you could play this game indefinitely.
Yeah. I feel like this is the exact opposite of Orleone, where Orleone, I was enjoying the game despite the artwork. And this one, I feel like I would sit there and just lose myself in the artwork is, you know, how beautiful it is. So regardless of whether the game itself was good or not, it would just be enjoyable to look at. So on my table is a game that I just got, but I haven't actually played my hard copy yet. It's Wolves, designed by Connor Alexander and published by Coyote and Crow. This is a game that we reviewed last year with Riley Stock from the Board Game Community Show and really enjoyed. It was probably one of the most unique game experiences that we'd had. It was a semi-co-op where you could win and be the winner of the game, but everybody had to survive in order to actually get to the point where we're even tallying up the score. That created some really interesting interactions. But what I wanted to talk about, because it's the part that's new to me, is the actual physical production. When we were playing it, we were noting that there wasn't a ton of art and relatively minimal production in terms of the pieces and whatnot. Actually having the physical copy now, I will say that the art hasn't changed much, but everything has been done so nicely. It's such a clean production. There's not, I don't think, a piece of plastic in this entire box. It's all nice, thick, heavy cardboard, beautiful little resources that are made of wood, meeples that are made of wood. Overall, just a super pleasant production on this one. Really looking forward to getting this one back on the table and enjoying this one again. And this time actually being able to do it while touching these lovely game pieces that come in the box. So hopefully one to get to the table soon.
Brian Chandler, the reviewer from colorblindgames.com and a regular community member of ours, posted his review of this over on our Facebook group. I was looking at the production and it looks really cool.
Yeah.
We always thought it had a neat design to it, but the production does really stand out. These nice tokens and the boards and everything are colorful and bright. I still think it was a bit of a miss that they didn't include some kind of artwork on like the leader cards, at least just to add a little bit of, you know, take away the abstraction and give it a little bit more flavor. But, you know, even like the resource cards, when you see them in full color, they look nice. They're bright color with some cool icons on it and stuff. So yeah, neat production, Chris. Do you have plans to get this played? Do you think you're going to get like one of your local groups, get five or six people together and try and give this a shot?
Possibly. I'm not sure if this would be a hit or not with my local game group, or if the next time I play it is going to be when I play it with you guys. But I'll have to relearn it a little bit and remind myself of the rules and then see if it's a game I can get played on a Thursday night.
Just remember, they make you play Reiner Knizia games all the time. You can put them through just about anything.
Well, it's a pretty good-natured group of folks, so I think that it would probably be it would be successful. Whether it was a hit or not, that's a little harder to say, but it would be successful, I think.
Well, I think that'll wrap up the show. Before we leave, I do have a great review. In fact, we got a few great reviews this week, but one of them is really long. So I'm going to start with that one this week, and we'll come back to the others in a coming week. So this was a review from Sweden. And by the way, if you enjoy the show, we really appreciate if you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or rate us on wherever you listen to the show. But it's really fun to read these reviews on Apple Podcasts where you can, you know, leave a full post about it. So this was from Exeriso from Sweden. I think this is our third Swedish review that we've had, maybe second. But in any case, that's awesome. Glad you guys are enjoying us over there. The review said, "I came for Everdell, found Thunder Road Vendetta, and stayed for you." It's a 5-star review. They said, "Hi, and thank you for a great podcast. I've played some board games during my life with focus on early 2000s Euro games like Catan, Carcassonne, and so on. Magic the Gathering has been with me for a large portion of my life. But during recent years with small children, I haven't prioritized playing it at all." So I'm going to call out this is a really long review. I'm going to call out just a couple statements here. We're not going to read over the whole thing, although we really appreciate it. Every word of it was awesome. They said, "I recently came back to more board gaming and a friend introduced me to Everdell at the beginning of 2024. So very recently, we're talking just a few months ago here. So as I usually do with a new interest, I scanned the web for resources and stumbled upon your podcast among others. I really like the way you communicate and you gave me the kind of input I was looking for. I listened to a few episodes of several podcasts, but yours is the only one that stuck. Boy, am I glad it did. Not my wallet, though. The excitement you had when you talked about Thunder Road Vendetta got me intrigued." And he goes on to talk about how he couldn't find a local copy, and then the Kickstarter came out, and he just went all in on the $300 all-in version. Man. By the way, so did Chris and I, so you're not alone there. I hope you enjoyed as much as we did. But then he goes on to say, "Even though I once more listened to other podcasts for Thunder Road Vendetta content, I still kept leaning towards you guys. Maybe I haven't found them all, but your podcast is the only one that got me hooked. For me, it's the way you talk to each other, how you all live ordinary lives with ordinary problems and a friendly tone. So far, I've listened to all episodes for 2024 and 2020, working my way to listen to all episodes made. Most games aren't for me, but I really like to hear your voices when I commute. Keep up the good work. Best regards, Eric." Eric, thank you so much. First of all, amazing that just a few months in, you've had to consume that much about board games from us, but I hope you find some winners in there, and really excited for you to get back into the hobby. Your entry into games is kind of what mine was, years of just playing a few of those games and then finding this hobby with so much variety, so many exciting things to experience and get into. I'm excited for you. So glad you're joining us for the ride here.
Yeah, Eric, thanks for the kind words. And just like Tim, my entry to the hobby was very similar. Found a couple podcasts, latched onto, and I was like, what are these guys talking about? I don't know half of these words they're saying or any of these terms, but I enjoyed every second of it. And it was just quenching to listen to these things. So thanks for enjoying our podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I really, really hope that you enjoy Thunder Road Vendetta when you get that big box. Because I figure on that one, at least if we're wrong, we're all going to be wrong together.
All right, cool. Well, that will wrap up this week's episode. We are very excited. Next week, we are all getting together in just a few days in Big Bear, California we rented a cabin. We're going to be there gaming for a few days. So it's going to be exciting. Most likely our next episode that you hear will be our recap of Big Bear Con, unless something else gets in the way. So look forward to that. I am planning to take a little bit of video on this trip and make a little vlog for our Patreon supporters, exclusively for our Patreon supporters. So if you want to get some visuals of the trip, of course, come out to patreon.com/boardgamehottakes and give us some support there. Otherwise, we enjoy interacting with you on Blue Sky as well as our Facebook group. Until next week, take care, everybody.
Good night, all.
Bye-bye.